Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Kenneth A. McLean. McLean is the W.E.B. Du Bois Professor of Literature and a Stephen H. Weiss Presidential Fellow at Cornell University. He is the author of 7 poetry collections and 2 collections of personal essays. His first, Walls, appeared in 1991. And his most recent, Color, Essays on Race, Family, and History, was published last month by the University of Notre Dame Press. Welcome to the show, Ken.
It's great to be here.
Now you're known primarily as a poet, so can you tell us what attracted you to that medium in the first place?
Poetry?
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, I came to Cornell as an undergraduate in 1969, and I wanted to be a politician.
Really?
And I got here, yeah. And, I'd come from Harlem. I got here, and this was in 1969, right? So the Vietnam War was going on. Civil rights struggle was going on. And I remember getting here, and I remember seeing students, interestingly enough, tray sliding. That's this Cornell tradition, which they're not supposed to do any longer, but you get a tray from the dining halls, and you go down the snow, right, into the street.
Ah.
And I was watching these kids, and I kept saying to myself, why are they doing this? You know, why are they having so much fun when the whole world is coming apart? And then I started to write things that I thought were poems. They were abysmal. Because literally what I was writing was just unadorned.
Mm. So raw.
Raw hate. I mean, I just kept saying, why are you this? And, you know, railing at people. And the thing is that art, as you know, right, has to do 2 things. It both has to make people confront things they don't want to confront, but it also has to give them the provender by which they, in some sense, can confront those things.
Yeah.
So it has to woo you in. That's why Eliot says, let us go, you and I. He doesn't drown you in the first line. Uh-huh. Although a good reader, if he's reading or she's reading the Love Song of J.F. Prufrock, understands that this is going to be a little bit more testy than they thought.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Uh-huh.
So I came to the Temple of Zeus, which is at that point in the basement of Goldwin Smith Hall, and it was a large, incredible auditorium with Greek statues. And there we had these readings every week, and 100 people from both the campus and downtown would come. Mm-hmm. And there was like a literary pecking order, almost like slam poetry now, but in a very different sort of métier. And people would read, and if you were good, people took you seriously. So I came as, you know, this freshman reading these things. And I remember Walter Slatoff and A.R. Emmons, who later became colleagues of mine, when I read these poems, they just put their hands over their head and put their head down. And I realized at that moment that I wasn't even in the kiddie pool.
Uh-huh,
I mean, I was just horrific. No, just horrific. Uh-huh. And then I had to learn that, you know, taking people's faces and throwing them into the mud does not make a poem,
mm-hmm.
right?
And I think all of us with a political sensibility probably had to learn that.
It's true.
Don't you think?
It's true.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, if you think about it, the people you most respect, for me, for example, poets such as Audre Lorde or Gwen Brooks, who are personally friends of mine, they did 2 things. They spoke about the world, but they also gave you that sense of courage so that you could also resist.
They did.
You have to do both things. The same thing, of course, with all the sort of great political poets we've had.
Indeed. Now you began writing essays in 1982 when your brother Paul died of alcoholism. What was it in the essay form that enabled you to confront some of these personal issues?
Well, actually, I never felt that poems should be didactic. Right. And in fact, I didn't really feel, at least personally, that poems should be personal in quite that way.
Mm.
And the work that I had to do, frankly, was work on myself. So it was therapy to some degree. But then I also realized that if I did it well, hopefully, I would provide corroboration for others. And that seems to me what writing is.
Mm-hmm.
Writing is a movement from oneself to other selves. It is a gift of your understanding, more frankly, like a vessel. I mean, in some sense, if I've done anything well, I've just stood in for others.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think anyone who doesn't do that is just being egocentric, right, or narcissistic. And I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wanted, in some sense, to, first of all, say, after the death of my brother, first of all, that he mattered.
Uh-huh.
Right? That if anyone dies, that is a loss to all of us. And I took a lot of this, interestingly enough, from James Baldwin's wonderful novella, Sonny's Blues, which, interestingly enough, I had read, again, while he was teaching us a summer school course, just 3 weeks before my brother died.
Wow.
And it was given to me, and I remember reading that thing and thinking about this and realizing, interestingly enough, that no matter how much you love someone, he or she might die. And that was really important to me. It gave me, if you will, the possibility for a life after that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I suddenly realized that, you know, whatever I did, as long as I did it with a sense of real trust, and as long as I wasn't dishonest, I did the best I could.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most people do.
Mm-hmm. So, and it freed you. I'm certain. Because mm-hmm. because that old saying that you can't really live your life if you spend most of it afraid of dying.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Well, interesting enough, I must admit that for some crazy reason, and I've never actually been afraid of death.
Mm.
I don't welcome it. And part of that, I think, comes to the fact that I just really like life. I'm shy. I'm reclusive. But I really love people.
Uh-huh,
they
uh-huh.
teach me so much.
I have met so many writers who are reclusive. That must be part of the gene pool.
Well, I think that you know, writers are condemned to writing. They don't choose it.
Uh-huh.
I don't understand the world until I write about it.
I was going to bring that up. But I also want to bring up, obviously, the new collection. And it's amazing. It's called Color, Essays on Race, Family, and History. And the first essay is called Shadow Boxing, dedicated to your father and about him. And talk to us about it.
Yeah, Shadowboxing is an essay that talks about a very astonishing moment. When I was about 5 years old, my dad and I went down to Macy's, and this would have been in 1956, and there were very few black people in the Mortonier stores at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different now in New
mm-hmm.
York.
Mm-hmm.
Let me first say that my father is a physician, but he, frankly, was a socialist, although he would never say that. He practiced in Harlem by desire. 75% of his patients couldn't pay. We had all kinds of barter going on.
Mm.
Both of my parents, in that way, were true saints. And if they taught me anything, it is largely that, you know, everyone in some sense is sacred, and your job is to make certain that everybody is seen as being valued.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, I'm with my dad, and my dad was, you know, probably the most gentle person I've ever seen. But we're going down the elevator, and all of a sudden, a white woman slaps my father, right, and says that he had pinched her. Now, my father might have been any number of things, but he would never do something like that. Nothing as odious as that. And so immediately turns around and slaps her back. Now, this, of course, for me, was astonishing. First of all, I'd never seen my father hit anyone. And more importantly, the idea of hitting a woman, of course, was just anathema to me. But there were also five white men in the car. And they immediately, right, bristle. And they're supposed to, in some sense, protect her. And I watched my father move from this moment, which was, of course, disconcerting, for want of a better term, for me, to then beginning to chide them. You know, he basically said, you know, well, look, if you want to do something about this, do something. But I only asked that it be a fair fight. And luckily, no one did anything. But I have to say that you must also understand that my dad graduated first in his class, well, actually second in his class from medical school in 3 years, and no white medical school in Boston, where he applied, would accept him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, the same thing happened. He was one generation too early. And so I think a lot of that anger expressed itself at that moment.
Yeah, it had to have welled up somehow. Because you talk about how your father worked at Columbia Presbyterian in New York City, taught medical students for 40 years, but never had private patient privileges.
Absolutely.
That is unbelievable.
Absolutely.
And explain to my listeners what that means.
Yeah, initially when a patient comes in, a doctor makes a diagnosis, and he or she brings the patient into the hospital. Right, and the patient is there until he or she is cured. In this case, my father, in effect, could make the diagnosis, but then could not bring the patient in without consulting a panel of other doctors, which,
that's
of course, was incredibly belittling to him.
Yeah, that's,
and
that's
to
what
his
they
patients.
Do with physician's assistants and so
Absolutely.
On.
Absolutely, he might as well have been an intern. And yet, he also, the other thing was, my father was such a good clinician. that I remember something I didn't write about in the book, but they would be these conferences. And my father would give these conferences for all fourth-year medical students, in fact, for the whole medical faculty. There would be 700 people there. The three times he did it, he was able to make the diagnosis that no one else in that hospital could make.
Hmm.
And these were very rare. One of them was a very rare brand of hyperthyroidism. And in fact, I remember Dr. David Spain, who's famous for doing the Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman autopsy, one of the great pathologists, said to me, you know, and of course, David was Jewish and had to deal with all those covenants too. But I remember him saying to me, your dad, unfortunately, was born just one generation too early.
Yeah.
Had he come a little bit later, he would have been chair of the department.
It's unbelievable. And it's such recent history.
Why?
To read that it lasted for 40 years.
Absolutely.
Astonished me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's talk about another essay. I mean, this whole book is so filled with wondrous, personal,
well,
powerful writing and topics. Let's talk about the essay titled Color, which was dedicated to and about your mother.
Yeah, my mom, interestingly enough, both of my parents were really brilliant. And I'm not just saying that, you know, it's not that they're just above average or something. Just
I believe
they really
it.
Were.
I believe it, yeah.
But my mom, when she was 63, my mother needed her birth certificate. Actually, 62. And for some reason, she hadn't looked at it and paid attention to it, couldn't find it. So finally, it came in the mail. She was born in a suburb of Boston, Dorchester. Lo and behold, it said that she was white. And I remember, I'm listening to my mother. I happened to be home from Cornell. And my mother just says, oh, my goodness, no, no, no. And then I hear my father, and I know my father, right, was not going to do anything about this because he loved my mother, but this was one narrative that he did not want to enter. And all of a sudden, I heard her say, no, 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 we got to do something about this. And I'm still listening. And then my mother said, damn. My mother never used those expletives. Never would happen.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And then I realized something very serious had happened. And she immediately said, we've got to change this. And so we did a mother-son sojourn to Boston.
And the reason why they thought she was white is because she was very light-skinned.
Yeah, my mother, my mother actually was beautiful. I mean, she looked just like Dorothy Dandridge, those of your listeners who know her. I mean, she was olive-skinned. I'm doing another book right now, which will talk a lot of the members of my family passed for very complex reasons.
Uh-huh.
I can't go in now.
Yeah.
But my mother could have been thought, black people would know that she was black.
Mm.
And that's the other thing, you know. She could have possibly been Italian. But doctors, of course, in Boston in 1913, when there was any doubt, you wouldn't want to make that mistake,
yeah,
given the sort of racial...
Yeah, and I'm sure they thought that she would prefer to be white anyway on her birth certificate.
I think often this is one of the funny things about race in America. Everyone always thinks that you want to be what they are. Whatever.
Oh, man.
So anyway, I should say one thing, too, a little bit more background. My mom also had done very serious theater and was actually in Broadway for a bit. And so she was an incredible actress. She also, by the way, was a pharmacist, graduated first in her class, but could never practice pharmacy, not because of race in this case, but because of gender. They weren't hiring women pharmacists, right, in New York City at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But both of my parents, and I say this, both of them never dwelled on the negative. That's why the thing with my father was so unusual, to see him actually strike out.
Mm.
But my mother actually never complained. I mean, she was just always put a good face on it and just do it. But this thing about race to her was essential. I remember her coming and she said, well, we're going to talk to a registrar. And the first registrar came out. A young man, probably went to Holy Cross or to Boston University, to Harvard. Very sweet, right? And it was clear that, you know, nothing was going to happen. He basically said, there's nothing I can do. And my mother was very nice. And she said, you know, well, I understand. I should also say that before this, she went through this incredible narrative worthy of an Oscar. she basically said, young man, you know, you can't understand what it is to be 62 and to live a lie. You know, I've been black all my 62 years. I've raised three children as a black person. I've gotten people through medical school. I've gone through this and that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken MacLean. We're talking about his most recent book of essays called Color, Essays on Race, Family, and History. Let's continue this about your mother trying to change the birth certificate that had claimed her as white.
Right. Anyway, so the registrar ultimately balked, understandably, because it is a legal document.
Mm.
So I figured, well, good, we're going to go back to New York. But oh, no. My mother said, rightfully, she said, well, you must realize that Boston is a pretty big city. I'm certain that they have more than one registrar.
Mm.
So we will come back tomorrow. And it dawned on me at that moment that I would probably be in Boston for the rest of my life. Probably I should apply to Harvard or something, because this is where we're going to end up. But anyway, the next day, another registrar came, right? And this young man was even younger. And interestingly enough, my mother immediately made a connection, realized that he hadn't yet learned the language of bureaucracy.
Mm.
In fact, he was in that kind of middle world or that nether world where he really was still kind of a man-child. And my mother, frankly, knew how to use this. You know, and she just jumped on it like a raptor, right? And said pretty much to the man, you know, young man, can you in some sense do something about a grave injustice? And I could hear the violins. And this poor young boy
That's a great story.
Looked at us, and then he suddenly disappeared, came back. And this was funny. I didn't actually use these terms in the essay, but it literally, I think, whited out the thing, you know, which seemed to be another kind of trope about this
uh-huh.
thing, but changed it, right, to black. And, of course, my mother was happy, and we were able to come home. I should say, by the way, that I doubt if that legally happened.
You said that in the essay, too, that
right.
he had just done it in the office and it didn't
right.
go through the
right.
the chain of whatever
right.
bureaucracy it needed to. Yeah.
Absolutely. But I do think that the importance for this essay, and one of the things that I've been very lucky, because it seems to me that my whole life has been a parable. Things have always come to me, right? And they can be used. But I think that's probably the writerly in all of us,
mm-hmm.
you know? I mean, if you use your life, you can learn from it. You either use experience or experience uses you.
Indeed. I agree with you on that. You also say in this essay that race, for me, is the Rosetta Stone. It informs everything, and it is the landscape by which all my determinations are made. Isn't that amazing that still, I mean,
Definitely.
Will we ever come to a point where one does not have to make exclamations like that?
Well, I guess I'd be happy if we would just see someone and say, that person's black, that person's Asian, that person's woman, that person's that, and that it would just be descriptive.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
What worries me is mm. not that you see things. I think just because these people always come up to me and say, I don't see you as being black. I'm saying, then what do you see me
as? That's unbelievable,
right?
Yeah.
So I don't want that either.
Mm.
No, I just want you to see reality as is. We're not colorblind. We have eyes, right?
Uh-huh.
We have senses.
Uh-huh.
Why do we other? That's what interests me and others. It's one thing to see someone as other, but why do we have to then bring in a whole, you know, wealth of other terms?
Well, you many call it pathological.
Absolutely.
The dialogue on race in this country, you call it pathological.
I think it is.
I agree
is.
With you.
I think it is. I mean, I think that, you know, and everybody's saying, trying to lay this all on poor Mr. Obama, somehow he's going to cure us of all our ills. It's going to take a lot more than even President Obama, and I am so delighted that he's there. I mean, it's about the only
absolutely.
Chance for us and possibly the chance for the world, from what I can see.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
no one should have to take the weight. It has taken us 300 years to create this mess. It's going to probably take us, not hopefully 300 years, but it's going to take us a generation of very pioneering, hardworking, self-analytical people
mm-hmm,
to get us
mm-hmm.
out of it. And yet I still see this. You know, it is wonderful. I will say this, that when I came to Cornell in 69, I think I could have said to many of my students that black people ate their children, and many of those students wouldn't know if that was true or not. And I'm saying
really?
That in all honesty. Yeah, it doesn't have to do with Cornell.
Right.
And I'm obviously
but you're talking about the time.
Somewhat hyperbolic here. But I'm saying that people knew very little about others at that point. And Cornell in 1969 was not a diverse place by any stretch
yeah.
of the imagination.
Yeah.
Now, when I go into a class, all of my students have seen black people in positions of power. You know, now the question is whether you're a good teacher or not. And
yeah.
that's an amazing,
that is
amazing,
an amazing
moment.
Change.
The other thing is that I will say that I look around Cornell now And I finally feel that this truly is a university. And for me, mm-hmm. it is just wondrous.
Yeah.
And I just hope we can replicate that right in this country.
So you're talking about a world-class, in every sense of the word, university. Yeah.
I mean, this is truly a university.
Yeah.
People from every walk of life are here. The only thing I also worry about, too, of course, is that I always want to make certain, and I think that one of the good things about Cornell, and I will say this, is that it's always been, or still is, for many students, a first-generation place.
Mm.
And that's very important to me.
Mm-hmm.
I do not want this school to be only the province of the rich, you know, are people who have gone to Phillips Exeter or the collegiate school or those kinds of places.
No, I know what you mean. I feel the same way. Now, before we run out of time, we must talk about the final essay in your incredible collection of essays. It's called Driving, and it's about your parents. Talk to us about it.
Yeah, driving, both of my parents had Alzheimer's, which is, of course, terrifying. And it's terrifying to my wife and me. So if I forget something now, I think about it.
Yeah.
But that was a very difficult essay for me to write. And let me explain why. I had to do two things. One, I had to honor my parents. And my parents, even in their diminished state of Alzheimer's, remained largely the people they were.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very lucky for that. They were always generous. They were, you know, magnificent. My mother, for example, she always was the height of gentility, and she remained that way, right? My father remained the doctor, and that, of course, was kind of funny, too, because I had to worry about him, you know, because the last thing to go was his medicine, and he was literally, for seconds there, practicing medicine in the nursing home. And I was a little I had to make certain he didn't have any prescription pads and become Dr. Feelgood, you know? but I was lucky that way, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, I was lucky also because I saw Alzheimer's as just another narrative. And by doing that, I could remove myself in a way from using myself as the only sort of crucible by which I defined them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that I remember talking actually to a psychiatrist about this at Washington U, who was astonished that I had gotten there. And he said, I'd never thought about that. And I was lucky because in some sense, both of my parents continued to tell stories as long as they were verbal. And though these stories never really touched down in reality, they always had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And you could make, if you thought about it, you could kind of map out what was happening for them by just seeing, for example, in the driving essay, I talk about the fact that I brought the whole family to see my dad. This was just about 3 months before he died. And I realized this would be the last time many of his family could see him. And of course, that was fraught with a lot of anxiety for my family because, you know, it's very hard to see somebody like that. In fact, it takes enormous courage for some people. In fact, my father's best friend, a guy named William Preston, literally his best friend, couldn't see my father in that diminished state. He just couldn't. And Bill had served in four campaigns of the Second World War. He had seen everything imaginable, but he couldn't face that. So I well understand this. But anyway, with those narratives, I started to realize if I could touch down and see how these narratives sort of interrelated, I could then at least have my father longer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I brought the family in, my father was saying things. He was very happy to meet his cousin Stephen. He remembered it. He said some appropriate things to his brother Warren.
Really?
You know? And I thought, well, wow. The next day I saw my dad, and I said, Dad, do you remember yesterday when everyone was there? And he said, nope, I don't remember anything. So then I said, well, wow. And then all of a sudden my father began to give his contra-narrative. And then he said, well, you know, yesterday something very strange happened. And I said, what, Dad? And he said, well, you know, there was a big party. And there were all these shrimp for everyone. And my father loved shrimp. That was a real extravagance for somebody during the Depression. And he said, and they let me stay out, and I could do anything I wanted. And there were boats in the harbor. And I realized what he was saying was something wonderful happened, and he enjoyed it. Yes, this is not the same thing as having your dad back. This is not having one of the most brilliant doctors in the country with you again.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still the same man with the same sense of sort of generosity and the same kind of ability to be this raconteur, which he was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I can talk at all, If I can talk at all, it's because my parents always told stories, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, I can tell by your by your essays and your poetry. Mm-hmm. Now, for 1 year, your parents were in the nursing home together.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and it was very cute in a weird way. Yes, both of them had Alzheimer's.
It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. And there were kind of really strange and funny moments. When I say funny, and these are always bittersweet, but I remember one point my father is holding my mother's hands, and they'd been married then for 54 years. And he looks at me, and he started to see me, interestingly enough, not as his son, but as his brother. And my nickname, of course, is Chip. And he said, "Chip, I have to tell you something." And I said, "What, Dad?" He said, "I'm going to get married again." And I said, "Really, Dad?" And then I'm in this weird sort of place because I realize, you know, he is married and that's my mother there. This is a little complicated.
Uh-huh.
So I said, "Well, Dad, first of all, who are you going to marry?" And then he said one of his best friends, right? And he said he was going to start a new family. And that was one of the first moments when really his medical training had gone right out the window. Because I realized the woman he was talking about was like 87. I don't think she was going to have a new family. It's possible, but we haven't quite got there with all the genetics or engineering we've done, right? And I suddenly realized we're actually in a very different place. So I said to myself, I said, "Okay, well, Dad, what about this woman over there?" I meant my mother. And then he looked at me, smiled, he said, "Well, I've talked to a lawyer about that." I said, "Really? And what did the lawyer say?" And he said, "Well, as long as I bring her with me, it'll be fine."
Oh,
and I said,
so
this
sweet.
Again is my father always. I mean, in my father's world, everyone is taken into account. And that was always the way he practiced medicine. In fact, in an essay, I remember as a kid, it was really incredible for me because I would walk with him and people would stop me and they would say, "Your father, he's a great man, you know." And then he would show me this child, right, that he had brought into the world.
Mm.
And it was kind of marvelous. And there was always that stuff going on because most of his patients, in some sense, you know, they'd give him tickets to stuff, which is why we always saw. I saw every play on Broadway.
You know, we're almost out of time. So I just want to end with asking you what you're working on next.
Yeah, right now I'm doing more essays. I've stopped writing poems as of the death of my brother Paul,
which is really
complicated. And I guess at some point, if I ever get really healthy again, if that's possible, I'll do it again. But right now, I'm working on some more essays. The saga seems to continue. Life always seems to give me more to think about. Hopefully, it won't take me 17 years to finish it.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of funny ones. I'm doing one now that's actually a very funny essay called Hertz Rent-A-Black, which goes back to, you know, it was very one of the complicated things. And again, I'm never going to speak badly about privilege. But one of the complicated things about being where we were was that we were often the first at different places. And there's a weight to that.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, Ken McLean, we actually have run out of time, unfortunately. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I highly recommend his book, Color, Essays on Race, Family, and History. You must read it. Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.